Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Cairo for an update on the elections in Egypt with Yasmin El-Rashidi, a former Middle East correspondent for The Wall Street Journal and the author of the e-book, The Battle for Egypt. We will discuss the strong showing by the Muslim Brotherhood and the fundamentalist Salafists in the first round of the parliamentary elections and look ahead to the next critical and contentious steps, which are the drafting of a new constitution and the presidential elections. Then we are joined in the studio by Julie Levine, who teaches at the USC School of Social Work and has been involved in the Occupy LA movement since its beginning. She will discuss the alleged mistreatment and police brutality the occupiers have endured since the police raid and the wider issues of the future direction of the Occupy movement and the 99%'s relationship to the corporate state. Then finally, Chris Fair joins us to examine what really happened in the recent clash between NATO forces and the Pakistanis, in which 24 Pakistani soldiers were killed. We will discuss why President Obama has not apologized to the Pakistanis because they opened fire first on the NATO and Afghan troops across the border, and when NATO gave the Pakistani military headquarters the coordinates to return fire, there was no objection. We will assess whether the U.S. will again turn a blind eye in order to open up supply routes into Afghanistan or take a firmer stand. I'm joined by Yasmin El-Rashidi, who is the author of the e-book, The Battle for Egypt. She is a frequent contributor to the New York Review of Books and is a former Middle East correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. She joins us from Cairo. Welcome to Background Briefing, Yasmin El-Rashidi.
Thank you, Ian.
And the elections are underway in Egypt, and they go on through January. It seems to operate on a regional basis. So far, there's been a certain amount of alarm expressed in the West and in the media here in the United States about how well the Muslim Brotherhood have done, but in particular how well the Salafists have done. So two questions. Let's begin with the Salafists. What is your sense of how much they pose a threat to the secular nature of Egyptian society?
I think sort of in the short term, I don't think they pose a threat. I think that both the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafists, you know, they have been portrayed as the big bad wolf, and they know it. And even though there are some sort of preachers and politicians among them who are speaking a very radical speak about what they want to see change in the country, for the most part, they seem to have an understanding that they have to first prove themselves to win the support of the people and to sort of dispel this idea that they are going to turn Egypt into Iran. So I think in the short term, we'll actually see them trying to win the support of people.
But isn't there a significant difference between the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafists?
There is. I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood are known to be more moderate. And the Salafists are much more, they're known to be, especially I think in their discourse, you know, aside from what they believe in their discourse in the past few months, the Salafists have been much more radical. They've thrown out, you know, all sorts of statements, we're going to ban alcohol, to bathing suits won't be allowed, to we need to cover all the pharaonic statues. You know, the Muslim Brotherhood are much savvier. They've been, you know, preparing for this moment for 80 years. They've been, you know, they were oppressed under the former regime. And so they're being much, much more careful. But I think ultimately, sort of bottom line and long term, they both essentially want the same thing, which is a state governed by the principles of the Islamic Sharia, which they feel will be sort of the answer to both the social and economic woes of the country. And I think in part their vision is that, you know, Egypt is in the state that it's in because it had veered so far from the principles of Islam.
Well, of course, Islam doesn't tell you how to pick up the garbage, does it, in terms of the day-to-day?
No, it doesn't. I mean, one thing I think we need to remember, you know, another difference between the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafists is the Muslim Brotherhood, although they were oppressed under the former regime and although they were not recognized as a political entity and they were not allowed to form a party, they were, you know, they were, they're very successful in business. They are among the leaders and the administrators in some of the most successful and well-managed syndicates and unions in the country. And so they have, they actually have a lot of, you know, hands-on practical experience. So I think, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood are bringing that to the table, and I think they will try and use those skills to create services for the people, to try and bring more order into the system, and to appease this fear of them. The Salafists, I think, will be forced in some way to compete. I mean, if they want to, you know, begin to win more support amongst the people, I think they'll have to do the same. And if one looks at how they've been campaigning the past few months, and how, as you said, you know, everyone is surprised at the percentage votes they seem to have so far. I think it's a direct result of the fact that they were using a very similar line to the Muslim Brotherhood, which is appealing to the poor with the offering of social services, speaking about the economy, speaking about the price of food. So I think, you know, we're seeing both Islamist factions walk a similar line to try to win support.
I imagine, though, Yasmin, that the Coptic Christian population in Egypt is quite concerned about the Nur, the Salafists doing so well. They are quite xenophobic towards Christians, aren't they? And the Copts are up to 15% of the population.
The Christian population and the moderate or secular Muslim population, which is like more of an upper-class population, are extremely concerned. I mean, the past few days, everywhere you go, people are talking about the Islamists and what this means and if we should leave the country or not leave the country. You know, one thing to point out is that the only Copts who made it into parliament are members of the Muslim Brotherhood. So there are Copts in parliament on sort of the ticket of the Brotherhood, and the Brotherhood, the Muslim Brotherhood, had made a huge effort, in particular in the past month, to show that they are open to Copts, they are open to women, they are moderate. But of course, it's not doing, you know, it's not helping to appease people. And right now, you know, there's been a lot of anger towards the de facto ruling military council over the past few months over how they've managed the affairs of the country in this transitional period. Right now, most of the Copts, and I would say a big chunk of the liberals, even the liberal Muslims, now feel that the hand of the military council in the country's affairs would be a good thing moving forward, because it's better than giving the Islamists sort of full control over a parliament. And I think that we'll begin to see, you know, liberals and Copts pushing for that as a way to try to secure their interests and try to secure a somewhat secular state.
So the turnout of about 60%, does that indicate, who were the 40% that didn't show up? Because my understanding is that the Liberals have felt very disappointed. They felt on both occasions with the original revolution in Tahrir Square and the more recent second revolution, if you will, that they were the ones that did the heavy lifting, and the Brotherhood and the Salafists sat on the sidelines, and now they're reaping all the rewards. So give us a sense of the 40% who didn't show up.
I mean, I would say the 40% who didn't show up are probably from the informal settlements, where I think the Muslim Brotherhood they have a large network, sort of on a grassroots network, but it's hard in the informal settlements to really get people to come out. And I think in part it's because those areas aren't sort of, you know, they're not formally part of any district. There aren't public schools there. And all the voting stations happen in you know, they turn public schools into voting stations. And in the informal areas, you don't have that. And I think that a sizable chunk, I mean, you know, the informal settlement, about 40% of the Egyptian population live in informal settlements. So I would say that you're seeing, you know, I think it's mainly from there. But to go back to, you know, again, where the votes are coming from, I think it's, and, you know, and the question of, you know, or the people, why the people who did the work at the revolution are now sort of being sidelined, I want to point out that the Muslim Brotherhood were actually critical to the revolution. On January 25th, there was a sizable turnout, but it was definitely not enough to make a revolution. And it was only on January 28th when the Muslim Brotherhood did come out that we formed the critical mass. And it was them who actually protected the square. They formed, you know, human shields. They formed barricades. They were the ones who were searching people. And so I think actually in many ways they did a huge amount of work for the revolution. And I don't think it's fair to say that, you know, they're now reaping the benefits. I think they were a part of it too.
But Yasmin,
I support an extremist state, but...
But just to clarify, though, something that I'm sure our audience is not aware of, and I hadn't heard about the idea that there are these informal areas that you referred to in the Egyptian electorate. So are they sort of poor areas with kind of migrant-type workers or without full government infrastructure? Give me a sense of what you mean by the informal areas.
I suppose the equivalent, in another country they would call them slum areas. Although they're not really slum areas. People have built brick houses, but they're not sort of part of, you know, the urban planning of the city. They're literally probably migrants from rural areas have come in closer to the city, have begun, you know, they started to build these red, you know, brick, a lot of unfinished housing. They're not, you know, they don't have the services that anyone in the city has. A lot of them don't have running water. They don't have, you know, a proper sewage system. The government isn't really servicing those areas.
You mentioned earlier, Yasmin, the idea that the Islamists, both the Muslim Brotherhood, who gained the most votes, 36.6%, and the Nur, which are the Islamists, the more fundamentalist group, Salafists, they captured 24.4%. That they're not intent upon creating an Iranian-style state, theocracy. But my understanding is that the Salafists, the Nur party, have been getting a lot of money from Saudi Arabia and the Gulf.
They do have support from the Gulf. They don't have sort of formal, or not to our knowledge, they don't have formal support in terms of state support, but they are getting money, you know, through some wealthy individuals, through mosques or foundations, you know, that are sort of channeling money to them here. So they are definitely, there is support in that way. I don't think it's on a state level, but they are, you know, well endowed, and part of that is coming from abroad, definitely.
So their model would be a Saudi-type model, would that be? Except there wouldn't be a royal family involved. What kind of political model are they following? Not the Iranians, surely.
I think that it would be, aside from actually sort of who's the ruler and who's, you know, the number two, on a you know, kind of just ideologically and in terms of, you know, the political ideology, I'd say it's much closer to Saudi Arabia. I think that they do see, you know, they want religion to govern the state in that way. They definitely, I would say, see it, that type of segregation between men and women. In terms of dress codes, I think that they definitely see things, you know, in a similar light. So I would say their vision is closer to the Saudi one. I don't think all of them. I think there are some Salafis who are sort of, you know, more Puritan than radical, and in that sense they're more moderate. But I would say that at the core, when you talk of the Salafis and what they want, it's definitely closer to a Saudi model.
Well, just in closing, Yasmin El-Rashidi, this first round of votes, or the subsequent rounds of votes, go on through January. I take it it's done on a regional basis. And then my understanding is that, assuming that the Supreme Council of the military rulers stick to their word, that the presidential elections will be in June, I believe. At least that was the latest offer. What's your sense of when you're saying that now the Liberals may actually need the military as a buffer against the Islamists? Would that mean that the president would likely to be from the liberal and secular camp? And what is it? What will be the division of powers between the presidential power and the parliament?
I mean, I think my sense of what happens next is I think there will be a huge battle sort of within and around Parliament about the drafting of the Constitution. I think the Islamists in Parliament will push to have full authority over, you know, who drafts the Constitution and how. I think the Liberals will do everything they can to push back against that and to involve the ruling military council, because the military council has, you know, been very clear and stated that Egypt should remain a democratic, civil, and modern state. And I think that, you know, the plan was that this constitution would be drafted and then we would have presidential elections, which theoretically will take place in June. My sense is that there will be so much argument and difference over the constitution that drafting will not take place in time for elections in June. When the elections happen, it's another story. And my sense is that, you know, the fact that we are seeing what appears to be a largely Islamist parliament, you know, coming into office, I don't necessarily think that means that we will also see an Islamist president. When you speak to people on the street, you feel that they want actually a statesman as a president who does, you know, who is rooted to the culture, who doesn't drink and, you know, is a Muslim, but someone, you know, like more along the lines of Amr Musa, for example. Even though I've heard, you know, a lot of people in the past few days have told me the only problem with Amr Musa is that he drinks wine. So I think that they're looking for more of a statesman and a diplomat than anything else. That's my sense. I mean, I think things could change, but right now that seems to be the discourse on the street.
But the real battle, as you just pointed out, Yasmin, it will be for the Constitution and how it's drafted.
I think so. I think that is what will divide the country once again in the coming months.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Yasmin El-Rashidi.
Thank you, Ian. Pleasure speaking to you.
Likewise. Again, I've been speaking with Yasmin El-Rashidi, who is the author of the e-book, The Battle for Egypt. She is a frequent contributor to the New York Review of Books and is a former Middle East correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. She joined us from Cairo. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back, joined in the studio by one of the organizers of the Occupy LA movement to talk about where the movement's heading.
Close to the water, the current's been sweeping us in. I'm just waiting on you to bring yourself justice.